David, too, for organizing this conference. I think it's going to be a great idea. I was going to say that it's a little late now, and it's probably back in the histories, that one of the aspects, surprising aspects of Malin measure was weather, but... So what I want to talk about is the relation between Malin measures of polynomials and special values of L functions. And the Malin measure is a special, is a particular kind of period in the sense of Sagi and Concevich-Sagi. So they defined a class of numbers which arise as integrals of rational functions defined over Q bar. And I guess we can roughly sort of think of this as the world of periods here and the world of, I'll just loosely call them L values. And well, partly their conjecture, or rather than conjectures, is more a sort of a philosophical point of view, a guiding principle, is basically that this set should be inside the other, so that all reasonable L function values should be themselves periods. And the second aspect of their paper, which I find the most interesting, is that if you have two periods and they happen to be the same, you should be able to prove it. So a buzzword way of saying that is that there are no accidental identities between periods. They have a precise version of what it means that you should be able to prove it. It's not just that the proof should basically, so identities should be a consequence of calculus. That is to say, there should be a finite series of essentially changes of variables or uses of Stokes' theorem or partitioning the integration domain into pieces that should allow you to go from one period to another in a provable way. And so I thought I would outline a little bit, I mean, nothing surprising here, but just to focus our minds into the questions. If we give ourselves a period, for example, the Malin measure of a polynomial with integer coefficients, say, and then what can we say about it? Well, our usual state is that we have no clue. Now, the next level would be that perhaps we can prove that, let's call this thing alpha, that alpha is commensurable with some L value. And we use the little symbol wiggle and the word commensurable to mean that the two numbers differ by an unspecified non-zero rational number. Differ meaning in the sense of ratio. The ratio is a non-zero rational number, which we may not know what it is. And then next level will be where we do know. And so this is a specific rational non-zero number R, which we can prove exactly what it is. And I guess deeper down, we would have something where R has a meaning. So, for example, when I'm thinking of this lowest level, and in a sense, a mean sort of guiding principle for all of this, in my mind anyway, is Dirichlet's class number formula. Where the rational number in question is the ratio of the class number of the field and the order of the roots of unity that it has. Now, often, so this I'm thinking of a arrows, meaning that you can give rigorous proofs, but often this you can move from this no clue usual state to other states by a computation effort, which I mean, this step is in itself not entirely trivial. To actually, you can write down the period as an abstract integral, but say if you want to know the number as a real number to high precision, it's not an entirely trivial fact. But suppose you can do that, then you can hope to get a possible move into this box in a numerical fashion by using, say, in general, linear dependence algorithms. And that is a great way of trying to understand what's going on, if not prove what you eventually might find. So the title of the talk, I won't repeat it to embarrass myself for the rest of times, but in any case, it's due to David, so... will be what I want to discuss is one specific example of something of this type. Number R happens to be 1/6, and mostly as an illustration of the incredible maneuverings that we need to do to actually get here. And hopefully, this is not a total waste of time in the sense that we're not really doing an incredible roundabout path to get some place where it would be there is an actually shorter path. So let me explain then the example. The example is a specific polynomial that we're going to say something about its Malle measure. In the notation of David, it's great to be giving the talk now, so it's a whole lot of things that I don't need to discuss. I'll just briefly say what that was. So this you should think of this as the powers of x this way and the powers of y this way. Okay. So this polynomial, David, in his own mysterious ways, came up with this polynomial and. By this computational route here, checked, that is to say, computed this to a high precision, and appeared to be the case, and that's sort of the left-hand side of the talk, that the number 1/6 here, the equal sign for the question marks means to all reasonable persons, this is true. In other words, you can compute both sides of the equation to a zillion decimals, and it looks right, but there's no way of proving it computationally. It appeared to hold an identity like this to hold, where chi here is a Dirichlet character, of conductor 15. So it's associated to the extension, quadratic extension q square root of minus 15q. Okay, so what I the goal of the talk would be to outline a proof of this fact. Not, as I say, so down here, so that a proof that this number actually is a 6. Okay, and the proof will take a detour into hyperbolic geometry, and so it's been great to have the talks that we had previously that we'll have introduced and talked about various of the concepts that we need. So before I do the specifics of this polynomial, let me mention somewhat of a more general facts. So the three general facts that seem to be at the heart of all the examples where such an identity holds, either numerically or actually provenly so. And the facts are as follows. So first, there exists a class of polynomials, of Laurent polynomials, with Q-bar coefficients, which are, so these are two variable polynomials over Q-bar. I'm going to call that class script A. And for this class, we have the property that any polynomial in this class, we can prove that pi times the Mellon measure of it is equal to a linear combination of values of the Bloch-Wigner dilogarithm. And my notation here is as follows. Psi 0 is a formal linear combination of algebraic numbers. So UJs here are non-zero Q-bar points, and RJs are rational numbers. And I'll say a bit more about how this comes about, but let me just point out that in a sense is analogous to what happens to polynomials in one variable. So polynomials in one variable, any polynomial in one variable, can be written as a sum of the values of the logarithm at the roots, and if you start with a cube polynomial, then this will be a linear combination of values or logs at Q-bar points. So it's not true that an arbitrary two-variable polynomial you'll have something of this sort, but I'll describe a class for polynomials for which this is the case. Okay, and the letter A should already point in the direction that was mentioned before of A polynomials of hyperbolic manifolds. So I'll come back to that. So this second fact is something that Walter Neumann already mentioned in his talk, which is that for a hyperbolic three-manifold, we have that its volume is given by something exactly of this sort. Okay? I should have said here the D of psi 0 is I extend the value of this function by linearity to these things. So I just simply mean the linear combination of the values of D. And this fact is a consequence of the fact that you can triangulate a manifold into ideal tetrahedra, and the volume of those tetrahedra is given by Bloch-Wigner dilogarithm, and moreover, the triangulation, the shapes describing the tetrahedra are algebraic numbers. And the third fact is, in my mind, the only unambiguous connection between the values of a zeta function and something else. And that is that if you have, I'll state it, and this is a more general fact, but I'll state it for hyperbolic three manifolds, if your manifold is arithmetic, so it's given by the quotient of a group you made up out of an arithmetic situation. I'll say something only in one specific case. Then the volume of that manifold is commensurable with an invariant, which I'll denote capital ZF2, which is, just think, is some simple multiple, meaning powers of pi and square roots of discriminants and other things. So essentially just the theta function of a certain field. So F is a certain number field, which is involved in the description of this manifold as an arithmetic manifold. Okay, so I guess I made some comments already on B. So as I said, these three facts, the combinations of these three facts in various ways are the only ways that I know to get a result of this kind. So, and the hard link is this last one. Okay, and I always find it very illuminating to realize the following fact, that ultimately this point C at the very heart of a proof is the fact that the size of SL2 of F, the points of SL2 over a finite field, is Q cubed 1 minus Q to the minus 2. So the 2 in the theta function evaluation comes from this 2 right here. Okay. All right, so let me describe then the part A. And as you might imagine, this polynomial here will be of that class. Okay. So what is this thing about this polynomial class that I describe here? Okay, so what is this class? Well, for one variable polynomials, we can talk about bounded measure of polynomials defined over Q, and it was often it often appeared in various people's talks already, the connection between the polynomial and its roots, and the going back and forth between the two. So we can think of the polynomial as the minimal polynomial, say, if it's an irreducible polynomial, we can think of the minimal polynomial of one of its roots. So the class A, let's say now over Q, will be also, let me just say it in a somewhat imprecise form first, these are minimal polynomials of some other gadgets, and those gadgets are symbols x, y, where x and y are rational functions on some algebraic curve x defined over Q. But these are pairs of functions x and y with the proviso that x and y is zero in K2 of the curve. Okay, so I'll explain what this means in a second, but the idea of a minimal polynomial here is the following. The function field of the curve is a transcendence degree 1, so you have two polynomials, there'll be some algebraic relation between them, okay, and I'm assuming that the ideal that generate is cut out by one polynomial. So just take a polynomial with relatively prime integer coefficients, clear denominators, and so on. So that's kind of the thing what happens with one variable polynomials if you give yourself a q-bar element and you look at this minimal polynomial. But the point is that there's an obstruction if we expect to have a way of actually performing the integration involved in the Mahler measure, and the obstruction is this one, that that the two pair of functions should actually give you a trivial element in this K2. Now, what does that mean? It means that we should be able to solve the following equation. Actually, to be concrete, to be more precise, there should be tensor with Q. So torsion is all going through the window in this business. So concretely, it means the following rather horrendous equation that needs to be solved. And this we also saw this type of thing briefly in Walter's talk. What we need to do, so the symbol being trivial is the following. We should be able to triangulate x wedge y. And I use the word triangulate because it is completely analogous to the triangulation of a manifold, a three manifold into ideal tetrahedra, if this were coming from a manifold, which it need not. So the identity is an algebraic identity in this wedge 2 group, which is sort of an unwieldy object if you never worked with it before. And I don't really have the time to say a whole lot more. And these ZIs, CJs, are, let's say Q, they could be Q bar, but let's just say Q. So they're rational functions on the same curve. So this is what it means for the symbol to be trivial. So my claim is that if the symbol determined by these two functions is trivial, which is this identity, that this identity holds, then we can actually compute the integral defined by the Mallet measure. And let me briefly sketch how that works. We define this differential eta of xy, which has also been mentioned already a few times. Which, if it doesn't come out of thin air, it can be, as in David's talk, it was mentioned as coming from Schlefly's formula for volumes, variation of volumes. You can also view it as the wedge product of log x and log y in the Lean cohomology. All right, now, so the observation that was already made is that if we are going to integrate this differential, where, for example, the absolute value of y is 1, then this part of it is gone, and what we get is log of x, the argument of y, which is precisely what you get if you perform if you use Jensen's formula in ones, which is as much as you can do it, in the original definition of the Mallet measure. So after you do all the a few steps extra, what you get is the following. You can phrase the Jensen's formula in the following form, that the Mallet measure is the integral of this differential on a certain path on the curve. And the path is determined by the following. You think of y riding on one of the circles, and then you think of x as a function of y, an algebraic function of y. Now, the Jensen formula has this funny cutoff property that only things that have absolute value bigger than 1 actually intervene. So one way to encode that is to say, well, then I define my path to be those points on the curve that satisfy that y moves in the circle, but the x's are bigger than 1 in absolute value. So rather than putting a plus here or modifying the integrand, I just can modify the path of integration. Now, the beauty about the sort of the advantage of this differential eta or respect to just log the original thing is a minor thing, but is useful and important, is that this differential is closed. And so in particular, we see that we could, for example, modify the path gamma, keeping the endpoints fixed and keeping the value the same. Now, the issue is that if the symbol is trivial, then not only is the differential is close, it actually is exact. And what is it? What are the integrals that we can integrate? Are the ones we know the primitive for. And so if this is exact, then we know a primitive for it. And in fact, the thing is very beautiful that eta of xy is d of d of psi, and psi is now on the function field is the sum of rj zeta j. So in other words, we have a function defined on the curve, which is sum of rj d of cj. And d of that is this differential eta, if this condition holds. And so what, in a way, this identity is algebraically integrating the differential. But it's completely algebraic. So this is a completely algebraic equation that we could attempt to solve or not. And if we do have an explicit solution of this equation, in particular we have an explicit integration of the differential. And now we can use Stokes' theorem and evaluate this integral as d evaluated at the, let me just put it this way, at the boundary of gamma. Okay? Rather, it should be psi of. Okay, so this is basically the proof that if we have this trivial symbol on an algebraic curve, then the minimal polynomial of that symbol is expressible in terms of the dilogarithm. One would need to be argue a little bit to, for example, guarantee that the endpoints, this path, are actually algebraic numbers. Well, I kind of waved my hands a bit. So you have two rational functions with this algebraic curve, and so there's an algebraic relation between them. And I'm assuming that so I, the map defined by x and y, I want the image to be dimension 1. And so it's that image is cut out by some polynomial, which we can take to be integer coefficients or relatively prime coefficients. So then we'll have something well-defined up to sine. Okay. Now, I believe that these two things are equivalent. What I'm claiming is one implies the other, which is really all I need. But I believe that this is, in fact, the case, that this being exact is precisely equivalent to this algebraic statement. But I'm not ready to swear by it.
I believe so.
You believe so, yeah.
Also, this could be expressed in terms of Totaro cycles.
Uh-huh. Okay, so now, so the story with this polynomial is as was as follows. I was trying to prove this identity because there was one example where a priori, I mean, this was done before the connection between this story and manifolds really arose. And so there's a route to try to prove this, which would be through the hyperbolic manifolds. For example, if you have a hyperbolic 3 manifold and you pick a cusp, as David explained, then you get this invariant, which is an A polynomial, which parametrizes certain types of representations of pi 1 of the manifold. And the one of the things that these five author paper, what they prove there is that this A polynomial of a manifold is in this class. So in other words, the differential form xy, which has a very specific topological meaning, they're the coordinates on this torus boundary, is exact. And moreover, the solution to this equation corresponds precisely to a triangulation of the manifold. So in other words, from a triangulation of a manifold, you produce a solution to this equation. Okay, so that's why I call that an algebraic triangulation, because this we can phrase in a completely general form. All right, so it would be great if this was an apolynomial of a manifold, we would have a good handle already on what's going on. And this did not appear to be an apolynomial of a manifold. Okay, so what I set out to do was to solve this equation. Okay, I don't believe that every polynomial in this class is a polynomial of a manifold. I don't see really a good reason why that should be true, but I don't really know. Okay, well, to cut this story short, Nathan Dunfield came in, and he did eventually find a manifold for which this is the A polynomial for. So there's that gives you a separate route to go to approve the identity. I should have said from the start that this is joint with David and Nathan. All right, so I should have probably stopped already, shouldn't I? Okay, should I just talk a few more minutes then?
Sure.
Yeah. So let me. I of course feel inclined to talk about what I did with this solving this equation, because I find it very interesting and it was a fun calculation. So let me just do that, and I would have to speak a longer to finish the whole thing. But I think I said enough. This is the derivative, yes. Now, the connection between this is a funny way of writing, if you like. The connection of this is really through, let me just say, some simple stuff, the theta function of this field at 2. So the hard link connection here is through the volume formula of Humbert's. Okay, which relates the, well, as I mentioned, the fact C, this theta function and the volume of arithmetic manifolds. So somehow what we need to do in order to pin this number down is start from this, somehow associate to it a manifold, from the manifold associate that manifold to the arithmetic one, which we know the volume of on the nose, and end up doing the connection. And that's exactly what Nathan did. So he found a manifold for which this is the A polynomial, and then the Bianchi manifold, the one you get by taking PSO2, well, as an orbifold, the PSO2, the ring of integers of this field, is some other manifold, and what he did was find a common cover. And so if you have a common cover, the volumes are going to be related by some rational number. And this was done by Snappy, so it was done in a computer, but the things that are needed to verify that you have indeed found a cover and so on, all of those things are done with precise arithmetic. So they're provably so. It's not just a guess. Okay. So this is a bona fide 1-6, which is somehow the point of my talk. Alright, so very quickly to say what is involved in solving this triangulation for these two functions. So this polynomial, as it happens, if you resolve the singularities, you get an elliptic curve of conductor 15. Surprise, surprise. 15 being this number right here. The functions x and y have devices supported on a certain subgroup, a finite subgroup. This is not really necessary, but this happens to be the case. This is kind of intriguing. If you take a cubic root of unity, the point in some specific model, the minimal model of E, this is a point of order 8, and then all zeros in poles of X and Y are in this subgroup. And so there's no guarantee that this should have worked, but it does. And so what I set out to do is find functions u, or let's say z, and 1 minus z, such that the devices of these two functions are among the points in H. And you can spot a few, and then you can apply automorphisms and spot a few more. And what you find is that you can find a inside wedge 2 of E of Q yeah, E of Q star, you find the lattice of rank 8, which is formed with pairings of the form Z, wedge 1 minus Z, with functions of this kind. And then, fortunately, so now you have a rank 8 lattice, and you hope that your guy XY is in there. Okay, and as it happened, it is. And then it becomes a linear algebra question to find the expression of XY in terms of these. Once, so it is there, you can solve for the RJs, and then, therefore, you have integrated the differential. And what you end up with that is a expression for this quantity as a specific value of the logarithm at algebraic integers. So at that point, you can invoke Borel's theorem, which will guarantee that this is true up to an unspecified rational number. Okay, and you can compute it to your heart's content. You will not be able to determine what it is. So in order to go one step down, you will have to do something more. And as it happens, for these small discriminant Bianchi groups, people have computed fundamental domains. In particular, Gangl has done it for several of these examples. I don't know if he was the first for this one, but anyway, there is a description of the fundamental domain of the action on hyperbolic space, so PSL2 of the ring of integers of this thing. And that gives you a triangulation of your manifold, and miraculously, if you plug in this triangulation, the boundary points, you precisely get Gangl's. I mean, there's many options for these functions. I just eventually managed to find a combination that precisely maps when you restrict to the boundary, where you have to do to find the final answer, to the one that Gangl found. So that directly connects. You get Mahler measure of values of the logarithm, and then those values of the logarithm directly connected to the Bianchi manifold by Humbert's formula, eventually related to this. So it's a long detour. So those are two different, in a way, two different proofs, but they all go through some hyperbolic manifold connection, and eventually Humbert's formula that relates this value with the volume of the corresponding arithmetic manifold. Okay, I spoke enough already. Thanks.
Is there some way of explaining the occurrence of meta functions or fields in this setup in terms of Denninger's ideas?
I think it's really more Borel's already. I mean, is the case of Borel. So in that case, we have a theorem, Borel's theorem, that relates L values to values of the logarithm on the block group up to unknown rational numbers. So, but ultimately, in my mind anyway, that boils down to the connection between volumes of arithmetic manifolds and theta functions.
What I was thinking one terms of, well, if this symbol was non-trivial, then you make it
something to
do with the L function of the
elliptic. Exactly, yeah. So there are two, in my mind, there's two cases where you can say something. In the case where the path... See, if the path were closed, that would be the end of the story. That's a zero. So that's the case that Denninger studied, at least mostly. And in that case, you don't want the differential to be exact. But the other side of the coin is where you have an exact differential, but you have a non-closed path. And that's, in a way, a simpler case. It's sort of related to number fields rather than to the... in fact... For a long time, it seemed that in order to get things like this, you probably expected the curve to be rational, or at least it seemed to be that way. And this construction seems to suggest that the curve could be arbitrary. That somehow it's not clear entirely how the geometry of the curve comes in at all. Yeah. So there's nothing about the L function of the underlying curve appearing. Oh yeah, no, that's another point. Yeah, why should 15 appear here? And I can tell you some, not now, but I can tell you some connections between this 15 and this one. Yeah, I love those statements. Yeah, No, it isn't. No, it isn't. No. The fact there was an elliptic curve is a nice feature because we have so many algorithms, so many things that we can do with elliptic curves that help a lot. But in a sense, I doubt that it's really intrinsically that important for this particular question. So, for example, manipulations of rational functions and so on is very nice. It's much easier to do with elliptic curves, at least for me, anyway.
I mentioned that I seem to find in many of my examples that there are many of examples, genus 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on, and it seems often that the number of different fields appearing is exactly the genus. But that's probably just the question.
What about the unification? The places of bad reduction.
Well, what happens is that these polynomials have an involution, the eight polynomials of manifolds, and the points you end up evaluating here are the points that are precisely absolute value of y equals 1, absolute value of x equals 1, and are on the curve. And the involution takes x and y to their inverses, and so the fixed points are 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1, which are on the torus. So those points always will contribute to this quantity. There may be others. And those, because it's an involution, for example, for elliptic curves, the involution is one that has fixed points precisely, and so what you end up finding is those points have to do with solving the equation 2p equals q. And that's how, for example, if it's a torsion point, that means you end up looking at torsion points. And we know the ramification of points of finite order from elliptic curves have to do with the conductor of the curve. And that was my sort of explanation of the connection between the two. And maybe that's a general fact. But I don't know how good an explanation it is, but it's some link.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, we probably should.